I got a text message and a woman asked me to call her. And when I called her, she said, my uncle killed Sister Kathy. So of course I was taken aback, and we talked some more, and I asked her a lot of questions, and we kind of were dubious at first.
But I've never been convinced that Maskell was directly hands-on involved in the murder. I didn't get the impression that Maskell was the kind of guy who would do that himself. Now, he might well have gotten somebody to do that. That struck me as a much more possible theory. Somewhere, somebody knows something, as the saying goes, but we don't know who.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds, and also creator of Discovery series Manhunt. Today, I have with me via Skype from London,
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard, advocate, author, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director at Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. And I'm also the casting director of The Argos File, a virtual reality film that just got into the Venice Film Festival after a debut at Sundance. So I'm really excited about that.
Awesome.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
That's really cool.
Thank you. Should we catch up on what we've all been doing? Because we haven't talked for a while. So.
Yeah, Laura, what have you been doing out in...
Out in Great Britain. Well, in London, it's actually sunny today for a change. I felt like we'd skipped a beat and gone to October in the week. It was just torrential downpour of rain, umbrellas at the ready. But I think... So last I told you about the fourth anniversary of Paladin, where we had tea on the terrace. Well... Since then, I mean, we're still campaigning for the register for serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders, as you know, and now the minister has offered us a meeting. So myself and Zoe, who you both know and met when we interviewed her, and John Clough will be going to meet with the minister who's leading on the new domestic violence bill. And hopefully we'll be trying to make a very clear evidence-based case for why this should be included in the new Domestic Violence Act. And something happened on Friday, which I was very excited about, which was the London Assembly. The leader for Labour, Len Duval, wrote an article, well, a report actually that was published, where he was supporting our calls for the register for serial perpetrators. So, you know, gradually we've got a lot of services who are supporting us as well as police services. So I'm feeling quite optimistic that this is going to happen.
Great.
But our listeners can certainly help by going onto our petition, which we put on our social media on Facebook and Twitter, and supporting the petition, signing it. But also if you are in the UK, please write to your MP and request that it is something that they raise in Parliament when they come back from recess, because the more voices, we reach that critical mass where they can't be ignored. And on Paladin's website, we actually have a template of a letter and all the information that somebody would need. So it would literally take 5 minutes. And it's so important, as we heard from Zoe's case. She was number 13 in terms of victims that the abuser had abused and attacked. So this isn't just Zoe's case, this is many others. So that's something that would be really helpful. And certainly, you know, I've been very busy with Paladin, organising our fundraiser and delivering training and working very hard with the team there.
And what have you been doing, Jim? Nothing?
Yeah,
man.
That's it. I've just been doing nothing else. Actually, I'm in the midst of writing episode 1306 of Criminal Minds. We're going to be bringing back a very notorious killer from season 3, Lucky. It's based on one of the worst cases that I ever had anything to do with in my entire career. And it is very disturbing. But that's why we're bringing him back. Remind people that there are monsters like this out there. And also, I've been working on a few other projects, and I think we've got an amazing set of cases to discuss here on Real Crime Profile coming up. And we have some great interviews to do as well. And I think, you know, all those things are going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, for listeners who have been asking, we will try to get Fitz back on to talk about Manhunt Unabomber, and Jim will talk about creating the series. And I just want to get into that. The casting, of course, is amazing. And I want to talk about all of that in an episode to come.
I've been talking to people over here, and just although it hasn't aired internationally, but people are seeing it, and I won't go into the details of that. But, you know, the reviews being amazing, I think a lot of people are sort of asking for the real story behind the story. So to take it beat by beat and comparing it to what you're seeing in the show versus what happened in reality. Because there are some bits, aren't there, Jim, that are quite different in terms of what happened?
Yeah, Discovery decided to go, you know, a little more dramatic than reality, and added some factors and some scenes and some issues that didn't actually exist, but the core of the story is still there. And the fact that Forensic Linguistics was born in Jim Fitzgerald's hunt for the Unabomber, and that science alone is now responsible for solving a number of cases that would literally never have been solved. And that's an amazing thing. That's an amazing feat for Jim Fitzgerald.
Okay. But now we're turning back to our coverage of the docuseries called The Keepers. We last left off. Jim was telling everybody, if you are being abused, to get out there and try to use your voice and get it reported, and law enforcement, you know, to come forward and try to help as much as you can if you suspect something going on. But now we're turning to episode 5, and it's called The Suspects.
Yes. And there is an entire list of suspects that they go through. And each one has its own little things, details that make you think, wow, could this have been the guy? And is it also possible that one or more of them colluded together? So obviously, Maskell is one of the chief suspects. And the fact that Father Maskell and Father Magnus showed up at Sister Kathy's apartment the night before, and apparently they were incensed, they really actually topped the list of suspects, because the very next evening she goes missing and her body is found.
Right. So we're going to get down that rabbit hole really soon. But first, this episode starts off with Lillian Mary Hughes. And if you recall, she had been Maskell's quote unquote secretary, who was witness to his abuse and wrote and he dictated all his abuses to her, and, you know, really scarred her for life.
And, well, more than that, too. Mm-hmm. She thinks that it's possible that he drugged her as well. He would always pour her a paper cup of Coke, and she thinks that maybe he drugged that drink and that maybe he took advantage of her when she was drugged, because she says that she has blacked out periods, times where she just doesn't remember, which is, an indicator that, like Bill Cosby's victims, they wake up and realize they've lost time. They have no idea what happened.
We know there's a number of drugs that can be used to facilitate that, like Rohypnol and GHB and numerous others that are available. And she does say that there are these periods of times that she cannot account for. And that also, she also talked about how he made her feel special in the role that she played.
So she does something really interesting. In the 90s, she finds out where he is, that he's in a mental hospital, and she takes a big risk, I guess, and she sneaks in there and finds him and gets right in his face to confront him. And according to her, he's just, you know, he's gone. He's not there. But I wanted to talk to you about that subject of confronting the offender who abused you or raped you. That's come up on our Facebook page recently. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, my thoughts are, it's up to the individual who survived that victimization to decide whether or not they want to do that. I do believe that in some cases, it's very cathartic. In my case, it was life-changing. My opportunity to confront him, not only with law enforcement, but face-to-face in a court of law, and let him know that I was no longer that child victim, turned the tables on him and reversed that imbalance of power that had existed when he victimized me and for years after. And so I think that was a pivotal point in my surviving and thriving, which I don't believe would have happened had I never had that opportunity. So I can't say that it's going to be the same for everyone, and some offenders are slippery enough that they get away with it, and some offenders are manipulative enough and powerful enough and rich enough to avoid prosecution, and it may be very frustrating for certain victims to try to get the offender who committed crimes against them prosecuted and put behind bars. But the fact is that it may also still be cathartic. It may also be a great thing when a victim grows up and can find his or her own footing and can face that person who offended against them and tell them exactly how they feel and exactly why what they did was wrong and how disgusting and horrible they are. I think that is a big thing. And I'll take it one step further, because many people who have survived childhood victimization get to a point where they actually forgive the offender. And that sounds like an outrageous comment. I mean, why would anybody want to forgive Maskell? Why, when he was such a horrific person? Well, the fact is that if you carry around that hatred, it's like a lifelong connection to this offender. And it seems that in many cases, myself included, I was kind of surprised because I was presenting in Canada with Sheldon Kennedy, actually, who was a professional hockey player who was victimized by his coach. And somebody stood up and asked if I had ever forgiven the offender. And in that moment, I said no. But you know what? I do right now. And it felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. It was severing the connection that I had been carrying around for decades, severing the weight that I felt that I had to always hate this guy. I always had to keep that in mind. And that was something that just was very unexpectedly relieving. And just by saying those words and realizing I don't have to carry that around anymore, the hell with him, let God deal with him, that's it. And so that is also a possibility for people who are victimized as kids.
Well, for me, I can't forgive, but I can forget. And for me, that's been the release, that sometimes I completely don't remember it all, and I hear other abuses, and I have to remind myself, oh yeah, that's you too. So I do feel a freedom without having to forgive. But I'd be worried about people to confront the offender who abused them, because that offender might still be dangerous, or it might be worse to, I don't know. Laura, can you weigh in on this?
You know, I think both of you have said some very powerful things there. You know, and it's such a personal thing, the journey of what happens for somebody. And certainly I feel, you know, like what Jim said, it can be part of the recovery process and restorative. And we actually have something called restorative justice here, which is for sort of burglary, robbery, where as part of the criminal justice system, someone in a facilitated session can confront the person who did the deed to them. And it can be used in violent crime as well. And it's seen to have some good results. The caveat we have is that it's not used as a standard or offered as a standard on power and control related crimes. So when we're talking about things like sex crimes, certainly domestic violence and stalking and the like, that it's not just something that's offered up. But I have to say that there are those people who do want that option. You know, forgiveness is part of some people's journey. And as you said, Lisa, sometimes, you know, things happen at a different stage, but you might be in the forgetting that you're compartmentalizing and that's not where you want to be. So I think it really is, you know, every case on its own merit, and there's no real one size fits all with any case anyway. But I certainly see, you know, for example, with some families that I've worked with, whose loved ones have been murdered. Those who have a criminal trial where they actually see the perpetrator in court and there is a process, then as upsetting and as difficult as that process is, they move on in their grief cycle and their stages of grieving. But those who never have that day, for example, if a perpetrator is unidentified or if they kill themselves, for example, after the event, then it can be incredibly difficult for, you know, families when they're grieving to, there's no such thing as closure, so that's not what I'm saying, but, you know, they don't get that opportunity to have their impact statement read and to have that dialogue, even though it's through the criminal justice system with a perpetrator. And I think, you know, we saw some of that, didn't we, with Brave Miss World, when we spoke with Cecilia Peck and we, you know, watched the documentary, Lenore's journey, some of the women she spoke to who felt that they had had their voice heard were at different stages to those women who still felt, you know, silenced, forgotten, and that they didn't get any form of outcome. And, you know, they seem to be in a slightly stuck place and space. So I think, you know, it can be very traumatic for some people. Finding forgiveness seems to, as Jim said, you know, lift something off of your shoulders that you're not carrying around in your heart as well. I think when you're carrying anger and resentment and hatred, you know, in your core, then of course we see some people suffer quite serious illness as well, because it can be very unhealthy to carry that around. But everyone has to find their own pathway on this transitioning, I think, from victimhood to survivor. And ultimately, Paladin, we try and get people through victimhood into survivor mode, and that they have survived something and move them out of that very difficult process of being victimized.
Yeah, and you said something, Lisa, about memory and forgetting. And I want to just make a distinction here between not being able to remember versus not thinking about it. You know, I know there were some traumatic things that happened to me when I was a kid, a pole vaulting accident where the pole broke and I smashed my head, and another time when I was very young, when I was jumping around on a picnic table and fell off onto the patio head first when I was a kid. Now, I just remembered that just now in this moment. I haven't thought about it in many years. It's in my memory, but it's just not something I think about all the time. And if you can live your life with that, that's fine. You know, that certainly works. Some people are able to segregate their memories and not think about horrible things. And as long as it doesn't affect, you know, your current life and your relationships, that's fine. But then there's also what people call recovered memories, memories that they couldn't access for a long period of time. But then when they get to a safe place in their life, they can access them. And again, this documentary does a good job in showing what used to be in terms of the state of the art of thinking about that psychologically, and how wrong they were back in the day to dismiss people's recovered memories. Not created memories, but recovered memories. And I think that now science has come around to respect that as a real phenomenon that is not, does not bring into question whether those memories are false. What it does is it acknowledges the fact that people do, to survive because of post-traumatic stress, they can separate off parts of their memory and not be able to go back there for a while to protect themselves. And then at some point, they can. That's what happened with many of the victims in this case. And I think that is why the civil case by these victims who sued Maskell and the church should not have been thrown out.
For the longest time, I was so angry at God. I thought, God let this happen. God did this to me. I was scared to death to talk about it, to experience it, to be able to accept the fact that this has happened.
But another thing that Lillian Hughes tells us that is incredibly important is the fact that Maskell had her type up the details of his victimization and the stories that these victims told. And the fact is that that is a perfect example of the kind of fantasy material that preferential offenders like to keep. It may not be child pornography or child abuse images, but it is child erotica. It is material that has a sexual significance to them, and it's related to children. And that kind of material can give you great insights into the offender's mind. So it just is a caveat on his offending that he wasn't a situational offender, somebody who wasn't sexually attracted to children, but he actually had deep ingrained fantasies that he wanted to relive over and over and over again. And that's why he had her type these up. And that's why he buried them when he was afraid that he was going to get caught, instead of destroying them, because he wanted to be able to access them again. And that is a typical behavior of a preferential offender. Right, Laura?
Right. And, you know, these are all, as you said, this is evidence and records. You know, where did they all end up? And of course, we spoke about May, didn't we? And the fact that she was continually saying that there wasn't enough evidence. But here he was keeping detailed evidence logs of everything that he did, but also other people and how they were involved and photographs and so on and so forth. So he kept very accurate records. And Lillian, bless her, you know, she thought that she was the chosen one. And again, this is another form of grooming and coercing someone, of singling them out, making them feel special. But all the while, you know, she's keeping these fantasy logs for him. And she's, you know, none the wiser in terms of A, what he does to her, because she can't remember it. But B, she's kind of complicit in it because she's writing it all down. I mean, that must be a really peculiar position for her to be in when it's her peer group and she's sort of reporting on them. But he coerces her in such a way that she feels special, in inverted commas. And I think that's a tough thing probably for her in her adulthood to reconcile in her mind. And that was probably part of why she wanted to try and track him down and find him and look him in the eye and confront him about what he made her do. But without a gun to her head, it was no doubt very difficult for her to come to terms with as well.
Something you said, Jim, makes me even more annoyed, I guess, with the prosecutor, who seemed like she just wanted the evidence to be delivered to her on a plate. But based on what you said, she should have known. She should have known that if they dug hard enough, they would find his obsessive
yes.
evidence, and also maybe trophies or whatever, that it's out there. But she
right.
she would have to actually get out of her car and look for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Issuing a subpoena immediately. Why didn't she do that? Why didn't she stand up a grand jury, issue subpoenas, and get all his records from the church? Why didn't he do that from the schools, from wherever the hell he was, from his home? And it just calls back to mind the statement that she made about, well, he was in this hospital and it wasn't really kind of facility that we could get access to him. I mean, like you said, Lisa, she just sat on her butt and did nothing. She did nothing for these victims. It's really disgusting. Just her sort of arrogance and just ignorance that was conveyed on the screen. Maddening.
If Lillian can get access to him, you know,
right.
Why couldn't? Never mind. Yeah.
I mean, that's a very good point, actually, Lisa, because it wasn't as if he was so difficult to track down at various stages. But there was just a complete lack of proactivity, wasn't there? Or a lack of will. And I don't know, Jim, you know, what are the standards and codes for a prosecutor? I mean, in terms of, it seems that, you know, she held quite high office, didn't she?
Yeah. She absolutely didn't do her job. There's just no question about it. And every other prosecutor that I know that saw the keepers and heard her speak was just incensed about her lack of professionalism and her lack of bringing justice for these girls and women. And just, she's personally responsible for him going on and on and on, victimizing many, many, many more girls and boys.
we got our girls, Gemma and Abby, coming back into the scene. And because they've been crowdsourcing information and opening up hotlines and the website, you know, they've been getting a lot of people calling them with leads and clues and this and the that. And it must have been very overwhelming for them to vet what is true, what's not true. But they do, and they start to go down some roads of possible suspects. And it leads them to two very different families. Do you want to jump in there? Or do you want me to describe who they are?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first one is Uncle Ed, a.k.a. Well, actually, it's Edgar Davidson, a.k.a. Uncle Ed. Debbie and Jan?
Yeah. So Debbie Yone contacts Abby and Gemma to say, I think my uncle killed Sister Kathy or was involved in this murder. And so they meet with her and her husband and her family to get to the bottom of this and who this uncle was and why they think he was connected.
So this is a typical aspect of a cold case homicide where years later, people will come forward. Other generations who actually care about justice will find out something and come forward. So this may not have been available to the police at the time. But what Debbie is able to say is that Uncle Ed's wife recalls him having a bloody shirt when he came home the night Kathy Chesnick disappeared. She also recalls him giving her a necklace that he couldn't afford at the time. The thing about that is, so everybody knows that Sister Kathy was out shopping that night for a gift for her sister because she was getting engaged. And what would have been great is when this information came forward, if the police immediately tracked down the stores in the area that Sister Kathy was shopping and found out any of them that sold jewelry, and look on their inventory to see if they had a necklace that is described by the wife of Uncle Ed. If that were the case, that could be a serious link to this murder.
Yeah, and Uncle Ed's ex-wife, Margaret, you know, there is a long interview with her. She doesn't show her face on camera, which I think is interesting. Even all these years later, she's afraid of what she knows. And I found her very credible. You know, I don't know if anybody else did. Her voice reminded me of Annie Potts. But anyway, and she's very detailed in what she remembers the night that her premature babies were in the hospital and then her husband comes home with a bloody shirt. I mean, she can recall lots and lots of detail. But does it really connect? I mean, I don't know.
Well, you don't know. Yeah. But the way to find out is to see if that necklace that he gave her was one that Kathy could have purchased. That would be a direct connection. We don't have it. Should it be done now? Yes. Why not? I mean, the murder is still open.
And it's interesting that at the time, if she suspected these things, she certainly did not feel like she was safe enough to go to the police. I mean, she has suspicion after suspicion of him. So, I mean, that's why I feel like it's I would believe it more if she had tried to contact the police and maybe they didn't believe her or something. But to have it come out now, it just feels like maybe it's a connection that we just can't really verify.
Yeah, but it sounds like she was in an abusive relationship. She had two twins that, you know, she had to take care of. She was very concerned about. And so the fact that she was coercively controlled or physically beaten or threatened in some other way, I mean, it's totally understandable if she didn't go to the police.
Yeah, and the context here is really important. You know, the first time when she challenges him about, you know, from what we hear from the docu is when she finds out he's not paying the bills and she confronts him and he chokes her and he threatens to kill her and said that very clearly that he would tell somebody else, sorry, he would tell other people that somebody else did it. And she really believed him. And although she left, she was still very scared of him. And this account I actually find very credible. And it's when she finds out she's pregnant with twins that she goes back to him. And so pregnancy can be a reason why women go back. And of course, being pregnant creates dependency as well. And that was the thing that sadly drew her back to him. But she said the relationship didn't last much longer and then gave the account of him coming home on November the 7th with a white shirt with blood on it. And that he actually said that whilst they saw on the news that Kathy was missing, that he smiled and smirked and said that by the time they find her body, it will be winter and she'll be buried under the snow, but she'll be dead. Interestingly, she was only missing at that point. So I think the detail of the things that she says actually sound very credible. And she, you know, she says that she separates when the twins are 1 year of age in 1971. I think she actually knows far more. And I think it would take somebody who's trained and a specialist to be able to talk to her, probably off camera, and find out much more information about what was going on. Because she also talks about him stealing a car, trying to pick up young girls from the school next to Kathy's apartments. So it sounds like he's certainly a predator, at the very least. And if we believe her account, he is coercively controlling and violent and abusive to women. So there is a clear, for me, a lot of my research and analysis is around domestic violence offenders who are offending outside the home. So I don't think that he can be ruled out. I think that this would require a real investigation. And I hope the FBI and others who are looking at these cases again are being incredibly thorough when interviewing people.
When the news came out on the TV that Sister Sesnik had disappeared, he was sitting in a chair right in front of the TV, and I was feeding the babies, and it's, you know, freeze frame in my head. And I heard the newsman saying that the sister had disappeared on November 7th. Right away, I'm getting a flashback. November 7th, that was the night before we picked up our baby. That was the night I came in with the bloody shirt. So I looked at him, and his reaction was rocking back in the chair and getting a smirk and kind of laughing. He said, by the time they find her body, it's going to be winter time. She's going to be buried under the snow. And I couldn't get my mind off of his reaction and my mind going back to that night. And my God, could Ed have done something like that?
Well, Gemma and Abby are definitely trying to be thorough, and they take the necklace to a jeweler and try to get it evaluated and such and such. And I just have to sort of pause here at how much I love this filmmaker for the things that he does, like showing how hard it is for Gemma and Abby to use Skype. I mean, it's adorable. And they have their little coffee filter maps of everybody. And then you see Gemma burning a pizza. I mean, these are things that are very endearing and kind of show the world that they're living in, that these two normal women are doing this very hard work to try to piece this all together. I mean, I just love that. And it makes it from being a very dry kind of an enterprise of a documentary and just gives it such a human heart and a face. And there's one shot of Gemma's dog. He's got the little cone on his head. I don't know if you remember that, Jim. But he's got the little, like, he's had surgery. And it's like, you know, it has nothing to do with anything except just show that even normal grandmas, you know, can get out there and be advocates for people. And I just really love those details.
Yeah, and I love them too. I think Gemma and Abby are great. And, you know, they obviously, the documentary does go to real lengths to try and find witnesses, speak to people. You know, the Facebook page was over 35,000, you know, people on it, sourced. And, you know, I think it's incredible what they've done. But why I talk about, you know, the police and the FBI is because these cases are reopened from statements that are made. And I think it is really important that individuals, you know, key and significant witnesses and other potential victims are spoken to, because, of course, we want to see these cases resolved. And the keepers, there's a lot to credit the keepers with. But there's no substitute for, you know, the thorough investigation where you have all your resources at your disposal, you know, high tech resources and people who are trained at cognitive, you know, interviewing and so on and so forth. So as much as I love, these two absolute heroines and sheroes, you know, them grappling with Skype and all these things, you know, basic technology in their investigation, I, you know, would like to see this particular line of inquiry thoroughly followed up and bottomed out, because he certainly sounds like he was a predator, and there may be, you know, many victims at his hands. And of course, he's never really been properly looked at by the police.
Absolutely. So then we turn down another road where we go to the Schmidt family, who also contact the ladies and say that their uncle also may have killed Kathy or had something to do with hiding her body, burying her body. And we go down a whole other road of sisters and brothers and mothers and a guy named Skippy. I mean, it is just keeping up with all the characters was amazing. But anyway, there is an Uncle Bill now that... whose family thinks that he may have been involved and who was quite haunted by the murder. And he lived across the way from Kathy. And there is a witness, his nephew, who says that he was involved in taking her body away. So it's just hard to, I mean, I don't even know what to think about all of this. What about you guys?
I don't know. Of the two, this was the one that I thought was less potentially involved, but who knows? Again, we need a thorough criminal investigation here. This is a homicide. This happens all the time, that people come up into the line of suspicion and then are either ruled in or ruled out, or they can't move it forward at all because of the passage of time. However, again, as I said, it is not unusual for years later in cold case homicides for people to be less afraid of coming forward and talking about people who they might have been afraid of at the time of the actual murder. It's one of the benefits of going back later and looking at a cold case homicide. But, of course, time has passed, memories fade, people confuse dates and times and places and things. So it can be more difficult to actually prove a case.
And that's the challenge with time and distance, isn't it, Jim? You know, memories fade. But certainly, you know, this Bill Schmidt does sound like an interesting character, and he sounded like he was a tortured soul. And his post-offence, you know, post-Kathy being found, post-her offence, not that he committed it, but he did try and kill himself five times, the sixth time he succeeded. So he took 49 pills and drank a load of alcohol, saying that he couldn't handle it anymore. So, of course, he is no longer alive. But I think there's some very interesting behaviours of him and Skippy, certainly. And so, of course, this is really about, you know, this brother Bob, the particular offender who's more sadistic, as the girls identify, one being far more sadistic than the others. And, of course, that would then mean, as we've already talked about, that they saw Maskell as sort of a protector of sorts, so with a real twist there. And that's really who they're trying to identify in episode 5. And of course, there are some revelations later on coming out about certain characteristics that this Father Bob had.
So Maskell is dead at this point. Uncle Billy is dead. So the only suspect currently that is alive is Edgar Davidson. And so they track him down. It looks like that they had help from his family, and the filmmaker is kind of following him from behind. And again, this is hats off to the filmmaker, because he makes this a very dramatic moment where you see the back of Edgar kind of shuffling along, and he turns, but you can't quite see his face. So that's the cliffhanger that we're left with at the end of episode 5, is like, will he talk to them? You know, what will he say? So it's kind of a genius way to end.
Yeah, it's a good way to end, but I think there's another important bit that moved me in episode 5, which was about Jean's husband, Mike, you know, who was her rock, of him getting cancer and cancer of the esophagus. And I found those scenes very moving, of her then caretaking him and, you know, talking about him as her rock and real strength that she got from him, and what a soulmate he was, that he never doubted her. Not once, you know, and when she's reading to him about the way that she feels about him, it really choked me up. I really, you know, felt that journey and just this incredible relationship, and just what a strong man he must have been to support her through all of this. And it was incredibly sad and moving of, you know, of him then passing. I don't know how you felt about it, Lisa.
Oh my God, are you kidding? It was incredibly moving, and I'm so happy that she had somebody like that in her life, and he also seemed completely in love with her, and I don't know how at such a young age you could know that that's your soulmate. You know, I don't know how that is, but it seemed to be absolutely the case. And looking at the pictures of them through the years and hearing her poem to him, I mean, oh my gosh, waterworks for sure.
Yeah, it was very sad, and at the same time, it showed how wonderful their relationship was, and the fact that he supported her through her struggles, and then she supported him through his. It's just so, I don't know, confusing how life works out sometimes. Just totally unfair.
And the fact, you know, she sort of says he kept so quiet and silent, and of course it affecting his esophagus, you know, it's cancer of the esophagus. I don't know, it just seemed a rather cruel twist of fate, whether that is coincidence or not, but she draws that correlation herself. You know, I have to say, I was just looking at some footage again of Robert Kardashian in the O.J. Simpson when he returns from Chicago. And I didn't realize, actually, that he had cancer of the esophagus as well. It affected his. And again, how ironic in one sense that, you know, I certainly believe that he kept a secret with that Louis Vuitton bag that had O.J. Simpson's name on it and American Airlines, that he seemed to, not just seemed, I saw the footage of him carrying it away from O.J. Simpson's house, but just that correlation again of him having cancer of the esophagus, and that's what he died from. And of course we know that he wouldn't let O.J. Simpson visit him on his deathbed. So Gene makes that, you know, talks about that specifically. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Jim or Lisa.
Well, I don't know if, you know, I do think it's ironic that they both end up with cancer of the esophagus. I don't know if cancer is that discerning in terms of what it attacks or what's vulnerable at a particular time, but I do believe that when somebody is under extreme stress, that they're more vulnerable, their immune system is weakened, and so cancer can take over. I know that from experience, and I know it, you know, from science. So it's not surprising that it happens to people. Good people who have been thrown into bad circumstances, or people who know they've done something wrong. So yeah. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So there was one point in episode 5 that was just really powerful for me, and that's when Gemma finally gets a call from somebody from Kathy's family who's willing to talk to them. And she has a phone call with Kathy's younger sister, Marilyn. And that phone call is so emotional for Gemma because she sounds just like Kathy. And it kind of brings back all of these emotions for her. And after she gets off the call, she puts her head down and she just cries. And I just wanted to just crawl through my television and just wrap my arms around her, because it feels like this is what she's been waiting for, to finally have that crack in the ice and have somebody from Kathy's family, you know, maybe try to help them and connect to what they're trying to do. I don't know how you guys felt about that.
Absolutely. That's a great lead into next week's episode, episode 6, where we're going to actually meet Edgar, Uncle Ed, one of the suspects in Sister Kathy's death, as well as Kathy's family members. So this is going to be a really interesting episode, and I think we're going to find out some really cool things.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is, please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.